I want anyone who's here struggling, going through a dark night of the soul, to not think that life has abandoned you or that something's wrong. Sometimes qualities are being cultivated in us during that dark night that are really answered prayer, and maybe not even just your answered prayer, but the answered prayer to the people you're here to serve and make a difference for in the future. And to just keep doing your best to choose love over and over and over, and find your way to that bright future so that you can really come into the fullness of your calling and your destiny.
Hello, boys and girls, ladies and gentlemen. This is Nishant, and welcome to another episode of the Nishant Girl Show. This show is for people who want to live a life of excellence, love, and joy. And my mission is to bring awareness about transformation and healing. My job on this show is to sit with the world-class experts to deconstruct the practices, routines, and habits to help you live a fulfilled and abundant life. Every Friday, I share an exclusive email to the newsletter subscribers, and this newsletter captures my weekly learnings in the form of books I'm reading, blogs and articles I'm exploring, recent podcast updates, and much, much more. You can find the newsletter link at my website, https://nishantgarg.me, nishantgarg.me. And today's guest is none other than Catherine Woodward Thomas. Catherine is the New York Times bestselling author of The Conscious Uncoupling, 5 Steps to Living Happily Even After, and Calling in the One, 7 Weeks to Attracting the Love of Your Life. She is an award-winning marriage and family psychotherapist. She is also the creator of the Conscious Uncoupling process, made known by Gwyneth Paltrow, and introduced a more conscious, creative, and respectful way to transition out of a primary love relationship. Catherine also trains and certifies people to become certified Calling in the One coaches and are Conscious Uncoupling coaches, and provides ongoing supervision and development to a vibrant community of her coaches from around the world. Over the past 2 decades, Catherine has had the honor of teaching hundreds of thousands of people from all corners of the globe to create conscious, loving relationships and to realize the higher potentials all their connections hold for health, happiness. She is a featured teacher with the international transformational educational giant Mindvalley, and she has appeared multiple times on The Today Show with Savannah Guthrie. She has been written about in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the London Times, and many other media outlets. So without further ado, please enjoy this wide-ranging, loving, conscious, and relationship-based conversation with Catherine Woodward Thomas. Catherine, welcome to the show.
It's a joy to be here. Thank you for having me.
It is my honor to have you on the show. I was looking forward to having this conversation from last 6 to 7 months, and finally we are here. Mm-hmm. I thought I would start with asking you, where did you grow up?
I grew up on Long Island in New York. I'm a New Yorker. And I still, even though I live in California for over 30 years now, I still think of New York as my home.
Do you recall any or one of your favorite stories from your teenage years?
You know, I had a rough time in my teenage years. But I'll tell you this. I had a rough time because my mother had been married 3 times by my age of 10, and 2 very bad divorces. And I was a little lost because we moved every year, and I didn't quite have a relational family around me that would have really, you know, created a lot of love or safety. I was what's called a latchkey kid, which meant that my mother was a single mother, and so she worked and she didn't get home till 6 o'clock. So when I was just a young girl, maybe 7, 8 years old, I'd come home to an empty house and I was alone. But I always had friends and stuff, but, you know, and all children kind of adjust to whatever is so. All of that kind of led into a certain rocky road when I was a teenager. I was a bit precocious. I was, drinking by the age of 14 and sleeping around with boys and just smoking cigarettes. I smoked a pack a day by the age of 14. So I was one of the kind of an at-risk kid. And I was headed for some trouble, but I actually had a spiritual awakening that I think might have really saved my life. When I was 14, I was just about to go out and do some drugs with some kids because I was just kind of on that pathway. And the girl who was going to give me the drugs suddenly got sick, and we were going to spend the weekend together. And so I had nothing to do that weekend because she had to cancel. And another friend of mine invited me to this little church that she was going to. She was a born-again Christian, and she invited me to go to this church. And we went to Sunday school, which was, you know, I'm there with my like leather jacket. I'm thinking I'm way too cool for the room. The woman who's leading the Sunday school class is, you know, this woman with blonde hair and buck teeth and very earnest and very caring. And she kept saying, you need to invite Jesus into your heart. And I was sitting there with my arms crossed, like, oh my gosh, when is this going to be over? But for some reason, at the end of the class, she said, we're all going to go around and everybody just say one line. And the whole time she'd been saying, you have to say, Jesus, come into my heart. So when it was my turn, I just out of my mouth, unpremeditated, said, Jesus, please come into my heart. Now, the phenomenal thing is I'd never heard about spiritual awakenings, but in that moment, I had what I call now a Kundalini awakening, where this rush of orange white light came from my crown chakra and flooded my body. And in that moment, I didn't know what it was, but I knew that there was a force and field of life that was greater than me, and that that force and field of life probably did not want me to do drugs. And I haven't done drugs to this day. And I'm sure it saved my life because, you know, from that moment on, I actually started to really become spiritually curious and very hungry for spiritual text and for prayer. And so I was kind of, you know, still a messed up kid, but I was a messed up kid that I'd be sitting in like the girls' room with a cigarette hanging out one side of my mouth. And then I'd be reading Bible passages to the girls in the bathroom who were like all going through boy troubles. And I was like the counselor for them. So anyway, that was my teenage years.
What is your relationship with Jesus now?
Well, I'm a devotee of the creative energies of life now that are oriented towards kind of an ever-emergent up-leveling of goodness, love, healing, unity, consciousness. I believe that the universe is going somewhere and that we are critical and our participation is critical to how much life can do through us to bring forth heaven on earth. I do believe that that is what we're all working towards. I think that we're living in quite dark days right now, which gets very confusing. And of course, a lot of us are very anxious about that. But I also remember that in the cycles of birth, that there's always that kind of dark passageway through the birth canal. And it looks like the end. And it looks like we're being squeezed and we're not really sure where we're going, but it is the passageway to new life. So I have great faith that something beautiful is wanting to happen and emerge between us, and that we are going to awaken to greater levels of love in our relationship with each other.
At what point in your life did you start practicing spirituality on a conscious level?
I think I started practicing really after that awakening, but in a way that was quite black and white. You know, I think any kind of fundamentalist religion that we get involved with has both beautiful light to it, but it also has a kind of either or, good, bad, good, evil quality to it that has us almost falling off the wagon a lot. And I think that there's not a lot of shades of gray, and there's not a lot of room to question and to begin to discover things for yourself. There's almost an external authority in all of it. And this is how it works. This is how it doesn't work. This is what God wants from you. This isn't what you're supposed to be doing. This is what you're not supposed to be doing. I think the more mature spiritual path emerges when we start to ask questions and we even allow ourselves to go into great doubt. And we start to poke holes through the kind of absolute doctrines that we have been trying our best to adhere to. So what happened for me in that particular journey is I did kind of take it as far as I could. I went to Bible college and I was going to study to be a missionary. And when I was 19, I was actually praying quite fervently to make a difference with my life. And as a matter of fact, when I was in Bible college, I spent many hours a day in prayer and meditation, in reading Bible passages, and my main prayer was that God would use my life for good, that something beautiful would happen from my life. And I was quite diligent about it. I had quite a hunger for that to happen. At the same time, I was very heartbroken because in order to follow my path, my spiritual path, I was a throwaway from my family. They did not like that path. They did not understand it. They did not respect it. And they basically told me I was on my own. So I was quite young when I left home. And I didn't have a whole lot of support. I had some friends who were supporting me, but I lived pretty much hand to mouth and kind of a very poor lifestyle. I remember not having enough money to buy stockings at the time, which we did wear stockings back then. And I didn't have money to buy food, and I had friends buying me food and all sorts of stuff. So there was a big sacrifice that was being made. But what happened that was kind of shocking to me, and I think that this might be relevant to some listeners here, is that I had an expectation that because I was praying this prayer, that what was going to happen next is that I would be offered a wonderful position as a minister somewhere. I would find a ministry. I would start being used in the way that I had it in my mind, I was going to be used. And what happened instead is, even with my very thin little support system, my best friend, who was also at the Bible school with me, turned against me. Took all of my friends with her. The man I had dated, or the boy I had dated all through high school that I thought I would marry, married someone else. I started to have health issues. I went into a compulsive overeating addiction. I gained 50 pounds. I had no friends. I was poor. And I thought that God had abandoned me. And so I stopped praying. And I actually went into deep doubt. And I just assumed that somehow life was not on my side any longer. And I went into years of addiction, and I still managed to stay in school. I did drop out. I became a Bible school dropout, but I did go back to college, and I first was going to become a school teacher, and then I found my way to the Tisch School of the Arts at NYU. I'm not really sure quite how that happened, but moved into New York City. So I had, you know, some good things were happening, but I was pretty messed up and I was pretty discouraged and crushed as a person. My eating addiction was quite out of control. And my mother's third marriage was falling apart. I got kind of stuck in the middle there. So there were a lot of really kind of negative things happening. And I ended up bottoming out on the food addiction. I could not control it. And I was really non-functional. I could not even work. I call myself a low bottom compulsive overeater. And at that point, I went into the 12-step program. I found Overeaters Anonymous. And I had a choice to make, because you have to pray in the 12-step program. It is a spiritual program. And so it began little by little to thaw me out. And frankly, my first prayer looked anything but holy, because my first prayer was all about how angry I was at God. Where were you? Why should I talk to you? You betrayed me. You let me down. But I stayed with the conversation. And the good news is that it got me then in dialogue with the divine.
Thank you for sharing, Catherine, your vulnerable story. I would love to know about your underlying beliefs and behaviors behind the addiction, because every addiction is connected to some childhood issues, childhood wounds. Is that correct? If this question makes sense.
Well, I think that there's different theories about it, but I do think that what most people can agree on, and I certainly adhere to this, is that any kind of addiction is really a substitute for certain inner capacities, like the ability to self-soothe or to self-regulate. And self-soothing and self-regulating really comes from internalizing the care and the consistency that we would have received when we were younger. So that could, you know, that disruption could happen from an acute trauma, like somebody dies or somebody leaves, or it could happen in what we call a developmental trauma, where you have a parent who is maybe chronically depressed, so extremely negligent, or you have a parent who's narcissistic, so, you know, missing the capacity to really mirror who you are or value you on your own terms. So somehow you have to always perform or disappear yourself in order to be accepted. So those are what we call developmental traumas, where you don't hit certain markers of, you know, what would have needed to develop in you to actually become capable of self-regulating your own inner experience and to become a separate autonomous self that is healthy. So I think the roots do have to do with probably early childhood. I think there's also, Shanta, an important to recognize that I don't know necessarily that people come in as blank slates and then it's all nurture. I think that there are certain traits that are inherited or maybe brought in on a soul level that has little to do with the environment that we're born into. I think that that just kind of remains in the mystery. But addictions themselves serve as a container of sorts to help regulate us internally. And I certainly know that that's what the food addiction was for me, and the blessing of that 12-step program, and also about reconnecting with a higher power, is that there was another container that was relational. And really, the way that nature has designed us to be happiest and healthiest is in relationship with others and in relationship with the energies of life. And, you know, and learning how to be in relationship with ourselves so that we can calm ourselves down when we're scared, or we can be in a kind of a self-encouraging relationship with ourselves. I think one of the main signs of mental health is the ability to really self-assess in a very accurate way without collapsing into shame, where we could have done better or how we co-created a situation that we're unhappy with. One of the signs of a lack of mental health is the inability to take personal responsibility without collapsing into hating yourself or feeling completely embarrassed and ashamed of yourself. So it's the recognition that we're human and we make mistakes and that we're all learning. And it's about the cultivation of humility to be able to admit these mistakes and then do better next time.
Catherine, how can someone self-assess their mental health and their relationships? Do you have any questions for that or some practices to do the self-work?
Oh, it's really a beautiful path that you're talking about. I think that you have to look at two types of development. And one is kind of intrapersonal development, which is the ability to begin to connect with yourself on a very deep level and kind of a friendship with yourself, for lack of a better word, where you're always at any given moment able to just say to yourself, sweetheart, what are you feeling? And notice what that feeling is, and to maybe even mirror it back. Oh, wow, honey, I can really see that you're feeling tired or sad or excited or whatever it is, without needing to necessarily fix it if it's a quote-unquote negative feeling, But just to learn how to send love to yourself and be in relationship with yourself while you're having that experience. And also to say, sweetheart, what are you needing right now? What are you needing? And to learn how to own our healthy needs and to differentiate them from what we might call an unhealthy need. An unhealthy need is going to be a need that was born from an unmet need from childhood that's kind of getting, you know, it's a bottomless pit need. Like, I need to be the center of attention all the time because I can never get enough validation that I matter, right? Or that I'm an important person. Or the way you might pull on somebody to, you know, overextend validation constantly because of you're feeling so insecure. So that it, we might call that an unhealthy need, where a healthy need is I need to feel heard and I need to feel respected. And I need the people that I'm closest to care if I share a feeling and to begin to respond to that, whether or not they can accommodate me, but at least to try. You know, I don't know if they can or can't, but at least they try and they care. So that's a valid need. So to be able to sort through that, those two. And then the other part of self-relations is this ability to ask yourself what you're making things mean. What's the story in your body about who you are and about what's possible in your relationships with other people?
Do you feel that sometimes people have trouble recognizing if this need is healthy or unhealthy?
I think they do. I think a lot of us are confused about this, and particularly because I work with people who are single, there seems to be, I don't know if it's because of the, you know, the transient nature of our dating culture, but there seems to be an ideal that I'm not really supposed to need anything from anyone in order to be, you know, a valuable person. But the problem with that is that nature has not designed us to not need things from each other. And that, in fact, relationship is about healthy interdependence. It's about the cultivation of a we consciousness and the recognition that there is a certain vulnerability that we have with each other, and that it is good and holy for us to actually need certain things from each other. And that the best of relationships is when both people see what their partner needs and is able to respond, you know, with good intentions and with some capacity to meet those needs. So that makes for a very good partnership. So what I see a lot of times in people who are single is that they're trying to pretend that they don't have any needs because they're throwing the baby out with the bathwater. They know that they don't want to show up as needy. But here's the thing about neediness. Neediness is a need that you have, a desire that you have that's kind of on top of a belief that you cannot have what you want.
And going back, why did you choose the path of becoming a licensed marriage and family therapist?
I suppose because that's how I was led. I mean, I've been a student of transformation for many, many years. I studied with Werner Erhard and was for many years participated in programs that were really about rapid transformation. And I also was in the 12-step program for 12 years. And I was a spiritual practitioner. I attended services at Science of Mind churches. I was a meditator. I've done a lot of different things. The pathway of the marriage family therapist license was a very good way to get grounded in the principles of psychology, but also it was a credential that would allow me to begin to build what I really was here to build. So I love the modality, but I will say that I have pretty fresh ideas about marriage family therapy that are not inside of that particular modality at this point. And so I'm working on, I actually train a lot of therapists in the modalities that I've created that really synthesize all of these modalities into a cohesive program that's really about this transformation of identity. So when I went back and I said, you know, we have these needs that are based on unhealthy beliefs, For example, I am all alone and no one is really there for me. That's what might be, you know, the conclusions that we came to when we were too young to know any better based on what was happening. But every time we go into a relationship, we might come there as our strong self, but the moment you feel disappointed or the moment you start needing something from someone, you start feeling vulnerable, you might drop down and collapse into that old story of that tender, younger part of you. So what I've been developing is how do we name that story and see where it is in our body and begin to mentor that self to a more true perspective so that we're not trying to do our relationships from that kind of younger, wounded place, particularly when we get quote-unquote triggered, but we're actually able to locate ourselves as an adult and mentor that part of ourselves that so easily collapses into the story and stay present with our adult self, with the person we're dating or the person we hope to be in relationship with or are in relationship with, and be able to work that through with them as equal partners, both holding power inside of mutual care and recognition that we're all growing together.
In the preparation of this conversation, I read that you attracted your partner at the age of 42. Is that correct?
Well, I attracted my first husband, who I was married to for 10 years, at the age of 41. I had set an intention to be engaged by my 42nd birthday. And I had no prospects for a husband, but I started to really, rather than run out to try and find someone, I really went within and I said, you know, who would I need to be in order to be engaged by my 42nd birthday? And I started to use visioning practices to imagine I was already in that partnership. What did it sound like when he was singing in the shower? What did it taste like when he was letting me taste the soup that he was cooking on the stove, just putting it into my somatic self. And then I asked four very important questions. The first one, who am I in this relationship? Who am I in this future fulfilled? Because in my old story in relationship, I was pretty alone and no one was ever there for me. And inside that consciousness, I do things like lower my expectations that anyone ever would be there for me. So I would date married people who, of course, are never going to be there for me. Or I would somehow, you know, date people who clearly didn't have the capacity to be there for me because they were alcoholics or workaholics. So, you know, I really started to own myself as the source of my experience. And I really anchored into the deeper truth that I did not come here to be alone. I came here to love and be loved. It is my destiny. And inside of that consciousness, I started to say, well, who would I be in this? Like, how would I show up? So the second question I asked, what would I need to give up in order to manifest this vision? And I find that when we ask the universe a question like that, that we get a ton of answers.
What did you give up?
That's great. I had to give up an idea about myself that I was not valuable. You know, my family threw me away, so I kind of internalized that and made meaning of that as I'm not valuable. And I asked myself, you know, where do I feel that in my body? How old is that self? And what's really true about that? And I really woke up to, you know, I'm a woman who is worthy of being chosen. And I have incredible value to give. And I am worthy of a wonderful husband. So that was the power statement I came up with. But then I had to look at, well, how have I been showing up in ways that kind of, you know, seduce people or enroll people into the I'm not valuable story? So if you really start to take responsibility of your, you know, for yourself in how you're generating your own patterns, there's like a bunch of information there. So it's things about, you know, how do you present? You underpresent, or maybe you don't really stand up for your rights or negotiate for your needs, or maybe you sleep with someone too early. You just kind of give yourself away, even if you don't want them, just because they want you. So these are ways of being that someone who has an I'm not valuable false center is going to be inside of. And you can see that those ways of being actually generate more evidence for the I'm not valuable story. So we have to interrupt that and we have to say, wait, what's even really true about this idea? And if I was really standing in the center of my value, what would I be doing differently? How would I be showing up and engaging with myself, with others? Well, I would begin to value myself. I would ask myself, sweetheart, what do you need? Oh, I need more time to get to know this person. And then I would value myself with another person by saying, I'm sorry. I know you seem to want to hop into bed with me, but I'm not ready for that. And I don't know you enough. And I don't quite know what that means for each of us. And I want to take my time. And if he did not respect that, then clearly he's not the right person for me. So that's a different center to be living from. So that was one thing I gave up, Nijan, is that idea. The kind of, it's not just the idea, it's more like the identification with the story, the emotional story, I'm not valuable, and acting from that story, as opposed to really finding a deeper truth and living from that. So the third question is then, what would I need to embrace and or grow in order to live true and in integrity with the future I'm standing for, right? So, you know, here we are setting an intention for a future that is not going to happen unless we stand for it. And we're leaning into who we are inside of that, what we would need to let go of, and how now am I going to need to grow? Well, maybe I don't even know the difference between healthy needs and unhealthy needs. And I have to, you know, read a book about that. I have to attend a class about that. I have to work with a coach about that to help me to learn how to discern between my unhealthy needs and my healthy needs and really own my healthy needs as something I'm entitled to have that is really the foundation of good boundaries and keeping love safe for all involved. So then there's a growth that I need to engage in order to become who I would need to be to have the future that I desire.
Do you remember any one of the books you read when you were breaking up with your first husband?
Well, truthfully, the reason I wrote Conscious Uncoupling is I found that there weren't enough resources. No, there weren't enough books. And not for what I wanted to do, which is to do something very conscious. By the way, I just need to just tell you the fourth one because somebody will say, well, what's the fourth question? And then I'm going to come back to this question that you just asked. The fourth question is, what's my next step? And you ask the universe that, you're going to get an impression. Oh, I need to get rid of the clutter in my house. Oh, I need to clean my closet out. Oh, I need to call and make an apology to that person. Like, we know what's in the way and we have to be in action. We can't just ask God to give us something. We have to be co-creators of the future that we desire and find our way to that future one action at a time. Okay, so that's the fourth question. So Conscious Uncoupling was actually the first book of its kind, truthfully. I mean, there's now some really great books that followed, but Conscious Uncoupling, I think, was the first. I mean, I have a friend, Daphne Rose Kingma, who wrote a lovely book, Coming Apart.
Oh, wow. She has been on the podcast.
Oh, Daphne has. She's really delightful. Yes. So she was, you know, she's a very, she's kind of a futurist, Daphne. She's very progressive in her thinking. She did write a book called Coming Apart, and that was, you know, how to not get snagged by the emotional tendency to go to war. But most of the books on the market, I think, were about, you know, dump the chump, kind of, you know, flush that man down the toilet, and really about blaming other person and kind of indulging our lesser nature as maybe a shortcut, you know, or all of these sayings, you know, the best way to get over someone is to get under someone else, or, you know, those kind of things. But I'm not a big fan of that because I think you're shortcutting the process and you can do a lot of damage to yourself and to other people. Number one is if, you know, on just a kind of, you know, overly simplistic model, you bring that baggage then into the next relationship, because your next relationship won't start when you meet the next person. Your next relationship begins with how you end with your last partner. So I wrote Conscious Uncoupling to fill a void of what I did not find in the marketplace. And then, of course, you know, a lot of people, it actually, when Gwyneth popped it into the lexicon, it radically spread that idea throughout the world. So Conscious Uncoupling lives on two different levels. One is the kind of paradigm of Conscious Uncoupling, like, oh, there's a way to do this well, where you're not going to, you know, wipe out the kids' college fund, or you're not going to do things that are uncharacteristically cruel and unkind and unfair, and you're not going to just move from soulmate to soul hate. So that kind of created a certain context for others then to follow suit and create much happier books about uncoupling. But the conscious uncoupling process, as I originally created it, is actually a very transformative five-step process on basically what do I do with these big feelings of rage, of despair, of hurt? How do I get through this trauma that might be one of the biggest traumas I've ever had to endure? How do I not screw up my kids as I go through this? How do I not dim down my chances for love in the future? So there's actually a five-step, very clear process that I train coaches and leading people. It's highly transformative. It helps people to take one of the worst times they've ever been through and to transform it entirely, and to be able to really use like that dark night of the soul as a rebirth and a reset, and to graduate from painful relational patterns that may have plagued them for decades.
And what are some of the biggest mistakes people make in approaching to find love in their life?
Before I go there, I just want to say that I have recoupled again with a beautiful man. And because I was able to do such a beautiful uncoupling with my first husband, who I affectionately call my husband, we're still friends. We're still great co-parents. He's friends with my now partner. I'm friends with his now partner. It gives a lot of cohesion to our family. And I really grew because I did a lot of, you know, a lot of deep inventory on myself, so that I learned certain things that I didn't know when I was married to Mark that have made my relationship with Michael now so much better and more grounded. So I'm really, you know, I'm really happy to be able to say that I created my second partner in my 60s. So that's pretty wonderful too, because I know a lot of people think they're too old for love. I say, no, it's never too late for love. Michael was almost 70, or I think it was 69 going on 70 when I met him. And we're so happy. We're like teenagers in love for 3 years now. So
you are giving me hope.
Oh, good. Yes, of course there's hope, Nishat. You're only 34. You're just a baby. You're just coming into manhood now, just about ready to form your own family. I have every confidence in you. All right, so let's talk about the biggest mistakes. And you might want to share some of what you're learning, because you're a man who's on the path right now. Do you want to answer that question first?
The biggest mistake, yeah, definitely. The biggest mistake I have done in the past is not being able to communicate my needs, because I always felt needs are harmful. We should not communicate our needs to another partner. We should try to satisfy those needs on our own, which is not a good idea.
That's what I'm saying. We're so inside of this.
And not being
you,
able.
But where did you get that idea?
You know, I didn't know all these things up until 4 years ago, and I became a student of life. I started reading different books from psychology, spirituality, relationships. Esther Perel, the one person come to mind, and your work. How do we let go of those resentments, hurt in our lives?
Great question.
The mistake is not having self-worth, not realizing that I'm worthy of everything. When I talk about worthiness, it doesn't have any condition. It's unconditional. Self-love for myself, I hated myself for a long time. For first 30 years of my life, I hated myself that I look bad. I'm not good looking. I'm not this. I'm not that. So I started working on self-love and self-care. A lot of self-love and self-care. But self-love doesn't mean that we cannot have love from another person. Love from another person has complete different dimensions. But we still need to love ourselves and open ourselves to receive love from another person. If we are close enough, then we may not be able to receive love from somewhere else. So I had to open my heart through meditation, through different practices, to literally open myself that, okay, yes, I am ready right now to receive the kind of love I want to receive.
Wow, that's really touching, Ashan. Thank you for sharing that. I feel my heart really melting with your honesty and authenticity. And I think so many of us can really relate. I do think that there is kind of a cultural understanding or something we say to people who are chronically single. And I know people said it to me because I was single until I was in my early 40s, which I recall being somewhat painful because I too wanted a relationship for a very long time. But it's this saying that you must love yourself before you can love another. And I used to get very frustrated with that because I didn't know what that meant. And I was confused. Like, does that mean, you know, bubble baths, you know, I need to, you know, get more manicures. Like, what does that mean to love myself? And I've come to understand that loving yourself is really about the relationship that we cultivate with ourselves and learning how to identify those false beliefs, like you talked about, that I'm not worthy, and to be able to mentor ourselves to this deeper truth. Do you have an equivalent of a power statement about that idea that you're not worthy, that you actually say to yourself when you might feel that way again?
I used to have that, but now I don't have that self-worth issue. This realization happened early this year that I'm worthy of every love. If I go on a date or if I find a woman, they may not be for life. Maybe they are coming into my life to teach me something that I do not know, that I am not aware of. So I don't have self-worth issues now. Any rejection that happens, if that woman says no to me, they may be saying no to the projection of they are holding about me. They're not saying no to me. At the soul level, I'm complete. I'm wholehearted. Everybody is wholehearted. Everybody is complete. I'm not lacking anything. So this, when I come from this place, I don't have hurt. Yes, when I like somebody, when I love somebody, it hurts for a little bit. It is disappointing, but I come back on track. I don't stay on that track for a long, long time. And it has taken me a long time to come to this point and being able to share. And earlier in this conversation, I mean, before we started recording, I shared with you that this is my personal conversation with you because I love the idea of love relationships because this is who I am. I am love.
That's beautiful. I am the source of love. That's beautiful. So, you know, I think I love that you're talking about unconditional love. And that is the foundation for where we all want to be in our relationships with others. And it is the foundation from which we can actually admit our mistakes and not collapse into shame, right? You just kind of unconditionally love your own humanity even when you make a mistake. And I think that there's an irony to relationship with others, because I think, you know, for example, with Michael and I, there is an unconditional love between us, but the relationship itself is conditional. And the relationship is conditional because trust is required for a good relationship, and trust is a conditional phenomenon. That's the complexity we're navigating. And one of the things I see people get confused about is they tolerate a lot of bad behavior, being really mistreated, because they're spiritual people and they want to be spiritual. And so they think that they're supposed to unconditionally love somebody. But you can say, look, love is unconditional, but relationships are not. And so one of the things we're looking for in relationship that we're building in ourselves and that we're looking for as a criteria has to do with two things. One is capacity, the capacity to actually love, to really build the capacity. And what I'm hearing you did, Nishant, is you built your capacity. You just took 4 years to really build your capacity to love yourself, which now gives you a foundation of love for another. You can love another person, really. And the other thing is character, good character. Do I keep my word or do I clean it up when I don't? Am I in integrity in my life? You know, you want somebody who's in integrity and honest and truthful and someone you can count on that when they say something that's how it is. And I find that we're confused about these qualities. And sometimes we put, oh, I want them to be wealthy first, or they need to look this way, or they need to, you know, have this kind of degree. And I say, well, all those things are nice, you know, but what you really need to find love and to create a wonderful relationship and a healthy relationship is both capacity for love and good character.
And the capacity to receive, right?
That's definitely up there, the capacity to receive love. Yeah, that's beautiful.
So in conscious uncoupling, you mentioned 5 steps to living happily even after. Could you describe in brief about these 5 steps?
Yeah, sure. I mean, we have to meet people where they are, you know, which is understandably in crisis. I mean, there's a difference between someone who is leaving a relationship and the person who's left. So the person who's leaving is not as traumatized because they've been thinking about this for a long time. They have been kind of creating an identity outside of the relationship for a while. So they're not as deeply shocked. But the person who is being left, even if there were warnings along the way, is often quite shocked and what we call deregulated, because relationships are our home, and that relationships regulate us. They regulate us physically and, you know, our body temperature, our blood pressure, our sleep patterns, all sorts of things get kind of synced up with the person that we're closest to. And so that's just on a physical level. And then on an emotional level, that person brings us regulation. It's kind of like, you know, if you've ever had a fight with a lover, you know, they're the person who just hurt you. But the moment, you know, you hear their voice after you've been separated from a while, maybe your body calms down because, oh, there's their voice again. And you missed them and now you feel more contained. So our relationships really are our home. And the brain and the body are kind of set up to keep us together. We're not actually built to come apart, which I think is a bit of an evolutionary hiccup. Because you have to remember, like, the whole happily ever after story, that was created 400 years ago and the lifespan was less than 40, and there wasn't really mobility. There weren't many options in life. So, you know, our lives are significantly different. The context of our lives are different. Just even in the last 100 years, we've doubled our lifespan. And what is natural for us, as much as we all aspire to living happily ever after, and I'm all for it for somebody who wants to really put that in their vision, I find my forever person. And I say, yeah, go for that, because 50% of marriages do. So why not you? But I think really statistically, the new norm for most of us is serial monogamy. That's just, you know, I'm not promoting it, I'm just reporting it. So the truth is that we don't really know how to come apart. And we're not really biologically prone to, if you, you know, you think it makes sense if you think about 1,000 years ago, if you wandered away from your tribe, you would probably die, right? So there's this feeling in our body, like, I'm going to die. And so nature will cling to a bond, and that's where we go from soulmate to soulmate, because better a negative bond than no bond at all. So you have to deal with all of that in step one. And step one is find emotional freedom. And it's about taking those big negative emotions and finding a way to transform them into the energies for positive change. So how to hold them so that you don't start acting out and going crazy, like keying somebody's car or, you know, giving all your possessions away just because you want to feel less guilty. And so not even asking for what's actually rightfully yours, all sorts of crazy stuff that we do in the midst of a breakup, or hoarding everything or taking everything or, you know, whatever we do. So we don't want to set up negative karma. You know, if you take whatever actions you take, whatever choices you make during this period, you're going to be kind of living with the fruits and the karma of those for many years to come, you and your children, if you have them. So we want to learn how to have conscious breakups that are in integrity with our beliefs. And that is not a small matter, given everything that's happening in your brain and your body, your fight or flight hormones, and how to calm ourselves down, how to regulate ourselves, and then how to take the difficult emotions and kind of harvest the growth that's wanting to happen. For example, inside of anger is also the reclamation of your right to be treated well. And you can take anger, which, you know, uncontained could do damage, and you say, you know what, from this moment forward, I'm setting an intention that I will only be in relationships that are fair, that are equal, that are respectful, that are kind. You know, you can set a positive intention, and then you have to be willing to do your work to make sure that that's so, and stop compromising or settling for less or whatever it is that you're doing. Step two is to reclaim your power in your life. And that has to do, believe it or not, with taking personal responsibility. So you talked about resentments before, and how do we get rid of resentments? So first of all, if you have a resentment, it's probably for good reason. And you have to validate, you know, how fragile, you know, how vulnerable we are to other people behaving badly. So if someone behaves badly, it hurts and there are consequences and we're left picking up the pieces. It's unfair. So that's a reality. However, if you really want to graduate from that, you've got to find a way to get out of a victimized perspective. And that victimized perspective can stay like a loop for decades. So you actually have to do it as a practice. And I like to say, even if it was 97% the other person's fault, what's your 3%? Because that's where the gold is. So for example, you know, if somebody cheated on you, clearly that's an injury. If they lied to you, clearly that is out of integrity. So you could spend a lot of time making them wrong. So it doesn't let them off the hook for you to look at your 3%. But you could actually, when you see your 3%, start to notice that you've been pushing that person away for a long time, that you've been holding things in your heart against them, and that you've been punishing them by withholding your love, and that's gone on for months, maybe years, and that you didn't actually communicate, you didn't actually negotiate for your needs, you didn't clean that up. It just became toxic in the field between you. And that's your 3% of that, because it's important for you to see that inside of that kind of immature way of relating, where you're just going to withhold your love and covertly punish someone by, you know, by being kind of, you know, separate and not, you know, sharing what's really going on for you, that created, you know, the breeding ground for disconnection. You never want that to happen again. You want your relationships to be healthier moving forward. You want to trust yourself that you're not going to duplicate another toxic relationship in the future. This is where people lose power. I've met people who have had bad breakups and didn't do this work, and then they just never really got into another relationship again. So you have to say, well, what's the growth? What's the amends to myself? Well, the amends in this case is when I'm upset with somebody, I engage it directly with that person before much time goes by. And even if I'm afraid of what they're going to say, even if I'm not really clear about what I need from them, even if I'm really angry and I'm afraid I'm going to blow something up, they're going to leave me, you know, I'm high maintenance, I've got to engage it directly. That integrity is more important than anything. That's where you start to rebuild trust in yourself. And you grow in the way that would make sure that this would never happen again. Step three is about going to those beliefs that we talked about, where you talked about, you know, a belief, I'm not worthy. When you did your work on that, Nishat, did you notice that that part of you was like a younger part of you, that that belief found its way kind of into your body long, long ago?
Oh, yes. Oh,
what did
yes.
you discover? How old is that part of you?
7 or 8.
Hmm.
When everybody started telling me that you are ugly.
Ah.
I'm not ugly. I know that. I'm a handsome man. I'm just kidding. So when everybody started...
But you are, actually. I'm kind of, you know, but the beliefs don't have to be at all true. They're so distorted.
Yes.
Go ahead. Who told you were ugly? You had like older siblings or something?
Friends, relatives, family members. So I had to walk through the parts, you know, IFS, internal family system, part therapy. In my mind, in my visualization meditation, I would go back into my childhood and give love and hugs and compassion, kindness to that small child, 7 or 8 year old child. Oh. And just so working through all those things, it has been healing journey.
Wow. So let me ask you, inside of the belief that you were not worthy, that you were ugly, how did that impact your dating life? If when you were centered there, yeah.
Yes, I was so shy to speak up to any women that I really like you and I want to take you on a date. I did not date for first 23, 24 years of my life. So my first girlfriend back, ex-girlfriend 6, 7 years ago, and she proposed me. Otherwise, I would have never told her that I really like her. I had to work through all this process that, okay, this is who I am. I believe in myself. I have a lot of love in myself, and this is how I'm going to show up. So when I started to show up differently,
yeah.
And what happens is that women were telling me that you have great smile, you look great, this or that. So in the beginning, I did not believe that. I was rejecting those compliments. So I had to accept those compliments. So sometimes we reject compliments when we don't believe in ourselves.
I just want to say to the audience, because this is an audio only, but you and I were on video before we hit the record button, and you're a very handsome man. Nishan is a very handsome man. It is absolutely not at all true that he is ugly.
Thank you so much, Catherine. So I did not plan to go this route. It is completely unplanned. I wasn't planned to speak up about my story.
Well, I'm glad because, you know, I think these are ideas that we're in, but people need to see examples. We all learn because we share our stories with each other. So this is very helpful. So step 3 in conscious uncoupling is waking up to the truth of who you are. I think this is what I find about breakups, is that breakups bring the wounded story right to the surface. I call it your source fracture story, because breakups, for the most part, are often an insult to identity. They, you know, we collapse right into the, oh my gosh, I'm not good enough, or I'm not wanted, or I'm not safe. You know, we go back into the old story that we formed in response to these relational traumas that we had when we were young. So they're because they're so in our face, it's so in our, actually it's in our bodies, these stories live like an emotional center in our bodies. It's so alive for us. And what happens to most of us is when we're feeling them, we kind of collapse into them. And we become overly identified with the self of that story. So in step 3, I have us wake up out of the story and start to mentor that younger self to more empowered meaning, which you did a beautiful job of demonstrating, Nishant, and begin to align with how you would show up from the truth. And then I do one final thing that I think is very powerful, which is what I call a soul-to-soul meditation, where you're bringing in you're kind of on a soul level, your former partner, who's probably, you know, projecting negatively onto you, and you have a very dignified, powerful conversation with them from the depth of your soul, right from your power and from your worthiness and your capacity to keep yourself safe, and you speak the truth. You imagine speaking the truth to that person and seeing them really get it. Because relationships are actually where beliefs are held. Beliefs are not held just in our own psyches. Beliefs are relational. And when we have somebody who we're very, very close to, we internalize each other, and we are vulnerable to their projections on us in how we feel about ourselves. And anyone who's had like a bad breakup where somebody's kind of blaming you and hating on you or has a big story about you knows that that story doesn't just go away. We kind of breathe it in and then we have to fight against it within ourselves. But it's almost like, you know, if you ever watch the old Superman TV series or movies, there's kryptonite, right? It's almost like you're walking around with kryptonite in your belly. It's weakening us. So we have to clean that up and really go back to someone and say, look, even I apologize for showing up in a way that deceived you into thinking I was not good enough for you. Now we're dealing with the other person and we're learning how to forgive and how to be forgiven and how to set a new intention for that relationship and how to start building a new culture between us, which is based on being as generous as you can be. You know, you help that person to move, or you give a little bit of extra cash if you can afford it, but, or you give extra time with the children, or you're somewhat flexible. You know, you do things that build a new culture of friendship and help the relationship move forward. Some people don't want to be friends, and that's fine. Idea sometimes to not be connected, no contact, but in your heart, you might wish them well. So that you're not filled with hatred. And then step five is about creating structures that really work for everyone. And so, for example, you might buy a duplex or buy two homes in the same neighborhood with your former partner if you have children, that kind of thing, so that you're really setting everyone up to win moving forward. And you're getting clear about the new agreements of who you are and what you can expect from each other moving forward, so that the energy is very clean and clear between you. And that's really the foundation in which people can thrive moving forward.
Thank you so much, Catherine, for sharing your expertise and wisdom. I wish we had more time. So it looks like we'll have to do another round at some point soon.
Absolutely, Nishant. Absolutely.
And where would you like our dear listeners to find you online?
Well, I do a lot of mentoring for free, and I'd like to do more, actually, but I do as much as I can. And if you go to CatherineWoodwardThomas.com, very often I have free seminars that are listed. And if you want to be notified of those and to receive a weekly free teaching that really helps us to evolve our relationships to a place of great happiness and health, just sign up for the Love Out Loud messages. I send them once a month, and they're teachings about love and just keep us all on the path together.
I am part of your newsletters, and they are absolutely worth it. And people can find all the links at nishantgarg.me, and we will put all the links and details about you, Catherine, in the show notes. Is there anything else you think we should have explored and that we didn't?
Well, you had asked me the question about the biggest obstacles for calling in the one, and I would love to share about that, and we'll share about that next time I go on, because, you know, I could chat forever about these things. But I think the most important thing for calling in the one is to just be bold about what it is that you're standing to create, and to start from the future, and to lean into who you would need to be. And the universe will start showing you your particular obstacles to love, and also help you if you're willing to be self-responsible. You are the source of your own experience. You will find a ton of information coming into you. And I also just want to finish up one of my stories. Right at the beginning, you asked me wonderful questions about my own spiritual journey. And I just want to say that it wasn't until I was 35, Nishant. Now, I spent all my 20s, much of my 30s, really just deep, deep, deep in my own inner work. And it wasn't until I was in my mid-30s that I started to feel well enough, and I wanted to just do something for others and not have it be about me all the time. And I decided to work with the homeless. I was a singer-songwriter, and I went down to Skid Row in L.A., to one of the missions, and I asked if I could run songwriting workshops with people who were turning their lives around and getting off the streets. And I didn't know what I was doing. I wasn't a therapist back then. and I just went in and started working with people, and their lives were changing so radically without me knowing really what to do or just making this up. And I had a huge epiphany. And I realized that when I went into that dark night of the soul, that that was actually answered prayer. Because now I had a gift. Because of all of the work I'd done on myself, I had an intuitive knowing of how people could change their lives from the most dire circumstances. And so I share the end of that story because I want anyone who's here struggling, going through a dark night of the soul, to not think that life has abandoned you or that something's wrong. Sometimes qualities are being cultivated in us during that dark night that are really answered prayer. And maybe not even just your answered prayer, but the answered prayer to the people you're here to serve and make a difference for in the future. And to just keep doing your best to choose love over and over and over and find your way to that bright future so that you can really come into the fullness of your calling and your destiny.
Calling in the 1-7 weeks to attract the love of your life. I will put the link in the show notes as well. So thank you so much, Catherine. And you speak from your heart. You gave hope to all of us. And talking to you means a lot.
It's been thank you, Nishant. Bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you for listening to this podcast episode today. If you did enjoy this, please subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, or you can visit https://nishantgarg.me nishantgarg.me. You can also share this episode with your loved ones to help them live a fulfilled life. You are not alone in this journey. We all struggle in life. There is no shame in talking about it. I go through my highs and lows. I get depressed, and these practices help me in living a resilient life. You can also do this. You've got this. Don't judge yourself. You are doing the best you can. And thank you so much again.